You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to episode number 12 of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. My name's Maga, and at the other end is my very good friend Matt. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
How are you doing?
Right now, I could have done with a bit more sleep, but otherwise okay. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. The rain is getting to me. I always get kind of woozy, but at the moment it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
I probably should tell you that I'm wearing my favorite Norma Jennings t-shirt, but more of that later.
I like that that kind of implies that you've also got a second favorite Norma Jennings t-shirt.
I do have a Norma Jennings t-shirt, but I don't have a second Norma Jennings t-shirt. But the one I have is pretty good, so it's probably my favorite. What have you been seeing, reading, watching, thinking about last month? Anything good? Anything bad?
Oh, that's difficult. I mean, you remember that last time we talked just a bit about how I was reading Lincoln in the Bardo?
Yes,
and
yes.
I finished that shortly after the podcast recording, actually. Really enjoyed that. I think mm-hmm. It's really one of the most enjoyable books I've read in a long time. Yeah. I love how it balances basically the pretty somber topic or theme that it has with a strange, surreal sense of humor.
Yeah.
I think it's really a fascinating novel. So that's definitely something I've done recently. But I think much more recently than that, two nights ago, I went to see Apocalypse Now Redux at the cinema.
Mm, yeah.
And I think I've recently realized that, you know, I was born in the 70s when so many of these iconic, especially American films, came out. But of course, it means that I didn't see any of them at the cinema. You know, all these 60s, 70s movies that all film geeks talk about.
Yeah.
I've only seen them on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, when you basically first see them on TV, that's just how it is. They're still great films, but it still does make a difference to see them on a big screen. And I think Apocalypse Now especially is one of those visionary pieces of filmmaking that if you're fully immersed in it on a big screen, it's very different from seeing it on even a big TV in the comfort of your living room.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the kind of insanity and the intensity of it just is ramped up. Though at the same time, I have to say that I'm not even sure. I think I've seen the Redux version once before, and it's not the best case for longer director cuts, I think. It's got some very good additional material.
Mm-hmm.
It's got some very bad additional material. But even the good additional material, I think, really harms, I think, the rhythm, the pace of the film. And when I say pace, I mean, it's not like it's a Michael Bay movie to begin with. It's relatively slow to begin with. But in the original version, I think there's still a steady flow. There's always something going on. And in the Redux version, I think the story and even just the flow of the story comes to a halt a couple of times, and that's not ideal.
Are you especially referring to that dinner scene with those French...
The French plantation?
Yeah.
It's, well, I think the French plantation, it's good material on its own.
Mm-hmm.
Well, except, I mean, there's basically Martin Sheen gets laid, and, you know, I'm happy for him, but it's a bit unnecessary. It feels like, you know, they felt, let's have a bit more sex here. The Playboy bunnies weren't enough. But I think the scene itself, thematically, and how it's filmed, is a good scene, the plantation scene. But where it comes in the film, it just brings the film down to a halt. At that point, we're ready
mm-hmm.
to move on down the river and finally get to Colonel Kurtz. And no, they delay it for another 15 minutes. And I think, even though the material is good, you're not going to be in the best place to appreciate that. I think the scene that really bothers me is, you know, there's basically the earlier scene with the Playboy bunnies that they basically bring out to motivate the soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, as they go down the river, they encounter the Playboy bunnies again in some kind of derelict camp. And the main character, the Martin Sheen character, he basically buys the sexual favors of the Playboy bunnies for, I think, two canisters of gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's, the film tries to be cute, it tries to be funny, and I think there and then it just comes across as plodding and sexist.
Mm-hmm. I had a problem with especially that scene as well, yeah. But it's been a while since I've seen it. I wanted to see it on the big screen as well, but, well, sort of missed it.
Yeah. I think it's also, I'm not sure, perhaps it's actually a very good film to watch when it's hot and summery and muggy. You know, you feel like you're in the jungle yourself in the comfort of a very, you know, comfy cinema chair. Yeah, you totally feel like you're in the war. You know, it's hell, man.
Yeah, yeah. You're very, very close to a heart attack and everything.
Exactly, yeah. You drop an acid or a few acids. I'm probably completely messing up the terminology here, revealing myself to be a total square.
It's funny you should mention The Square, because that's the movie I've watched on Blu-ray last week. It was at the cinemas around here for an astonishingly long time, I think. I didn't go and see it then, because I didn't like the director's first movie, Force Majeure. That's from 2014, I think. I think I blocked about it at the time.
I think he did some before that as well, but Force Majeure, I think, was probably the first big international success he had, yeah?
Yeah. The Square is... It seems to be one of those movies where people say, nah, it's absolute rubbish, don't go see it. And other people say, well, it's a masterpiece. You know, you're wrong. It's fantastic. It has a lot to say about this and that. I'm probably a small minority that thinks it's somewhere in the middle. There are very good things. There are other things that I think are not thought through very well. It's 2.5 hours long. I have no clue what it tries to say. It's mainly about Christian Danish arts curator. He's sort of the boss of the Rijksmuseum. It's a state-funded institution. The old art has to go and new art has to come in, mainly postmodern. At the beginning of the film, you can see an old war hero statue on a horse being taken away, heavily damaged. They also removed the plinth, and in its stead, they sort of put in a neon square in the cobblestones, marked with white neon tubes. That's the square of the title, of course. The museum is about postmodern art. The whole movie is constructed around a few strands. It's like someone filmed a short story collection, which happens to have the same characters now and again. One story strand is about Christian sleeping with an American interviewer played by Elizabeth Moss. She sort of, she has some kind of hidden agenda. I don't know what it is. The movie doesn't tell us. She quotes from the museum's homepage and tells Christian to explain himself. And he sort of can't. He excuses himself by saying, well, what that means, that object, subject, relational, postmodern illusion, blah, blah, blah. It basically means, if we took your handbag and put it in a museum, would it be art? And the Elizabeth Moss character nods and says, yeah, yeah, I can see. And you have no clue whether she means what she says. Is she gonna use that recorded statement on him later? She doesn't. But there's a weird vibe that comes off her. They later have sex, and she insists that he gives her the used condom. And you probably won't believe me, but they have some kind of tug of war with a full condom.
Okay. Yeah, that's. I hate it. I mean, every second film these days has that scene in it.
I have no idea why she is so hellbent on that condom, and you can almost tell that Christian thinks she's gonna inseminate herself with his semen in the bathroom. You know, hell. The movie doesn't tell us what that condom is for, what it's all about, what Anne, the Elizabeth Moss character, has in mind. No idea.
But, you know, if you put it in a museum, would it be art?
A full condom? Yeah, probably. Yeah. Would be smelly as hell, probably. There are other aspects of the movie that I liked better. It's probably the centerpiece of the movie. There's that Eastern European artist who behaves like an ape, played by Terry Notary. He enters the room during a gala of the big spenders for the museum. He behaves like an ape. People think it's funny. Only one guest is upset. They trade blows almost. And then the guest sits down again and the artist slash ape goes on behaving like an ape. He starts molesting a woman. He strokes her hair, he touches her, and she says, "Would you please stop?" And then he basically jumps off the table, drags her across the floor by her hair, and starts undressing her against her will. And the people in the room take a very, very long time to intervene. Mm-hmm. That's probably the center scene, the centerpiece of the whole movie, because it's also on the poster, Terry Notary standing on the table. Maybe the square wants to let us know that art can be harmful, art can be productive, inspiring, art can absolutely distract you from the real problems whatsoever. But if it's meant to say that, it's a cheap shot. The movie looks far too clever for what it really does. There's Christian walking from the bus to his place of work, and he's on the cell phone, and there's a homeless guy near him, and there's a woman who tries to raise money for people elsewhere who are very poor, and he says, no, I don't have any money on me. He's probably telling the truth, but he wants to sort of change the world with art, but he's not ready to give a fiver to someone who desperately needs it. That's sort of preachy and cheap, and it's with a raised moral finger, heal the ones next to you, blah, blah, blah. It's almost semi-biblical. Mm-hmm. If the square is about that, it's very cheap. But it's some parts of it are really well done. There's a boy who gets really upset because Christian has been... His cell phone gets stolen, and he can track where it is. And there's a building with about 15 apartments. He writes a threatening letter, prints it out 15 times, and puts it into the 15 letter boxes. "You are a thief. One of you has my cell phone and my wallet and my cufflinks. I would like them back. Bring them to the local 7-Eleven, the one under the bridge." And there's a young boy turning up at the 7-Eleven, and he says, "You know, you accused me of being a thief, and now my parents have grounded me. They've taken away my Xbox and my PlayStation privileges. I'm very upset. No, I'm not going to stop yelling, because I'm very upset you said I'm a thief, and I'm not, and my parents now think I'm a thief. I want you to come to my parents and apologize." I think that young boy, he sort of steals the movie. He has the most reason to be angry, and his feelings are genuine. You never know whether the Elizabeth Moss character is telling the truth or where she has some kind of hidden agenda. You don't know whether Christian is telling the truth about art or about whether he's really sorry having distributed those insulting leaflets and everything. That young boy is the most... genuine thing in the whole movie. He's on screen twice or three times, and he's always the best thing about the whole movie. The movie has some kind of a problem, I think, but on the whole, I liked it much better than Force Majeure, which I thought was a near miss. I'm looking forward to the next Ruben Östlund movie, of course. It's gonna be, I'm pretty sure it's gonna be as controversial as this one. You know, people will say it's really a masterpiece, or people will also say, nah, it's absolute crap, it's about nothing at all. To me, it was it had aspects of both.
I actually haven't seen a whole film of his yet. I started watching an early film of his, Play, but that one really rubbed me the wrong way. I mean, it tried to rub people the wrong way, but it's not that it irritated me intellectually or ethically. I just found it dreadfully boring, you know, and that kind of irritation is not one that I accept readily. I think I'm okay with films, TV series, even books boring me if I feel there's a payoff for the boredom. And with Play, I just felt I'm not the film's audience. I think he probably wanted to irritate other people. He probably wanted to irritate comfortably middle-class Swedish people, and I guess, you know, 2 out of 3 ain't enough in that case.
Yeah. No, I think with the square, he wanted to irritate everyone, and he apparently he got a great deal done that way. Yeah. Norma Jennings and all her friends. It's episode number 12. It's been around a dozen now. We've talked about Twin Peaks before. We focused on one episode. Today we would like to focus on Twin Peaks, The Return. We both liked it, but have a lot to say about it, don't we?
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I looked up what exactly the title was of the series. You said it's The Return, but I think I'm not even sure whether they officially made that statement. If you look at the Blu-ray case, it just says Twin Peaks. It's I've also heard it being referred to as the third season. But I think probably I could imagine Lynch didn't want to, you know, say it's exactly this or it's exactly that. He just said it's Twin Peaks. Make of it what you will.
Yeah, he probably said that a lot of the time.
Yeah. Exactly. Probably with a couple of expletives. But I think The Return is probably a good title for it in many ways. I mean, yes, it's the return of the series after 26 years. It's the return of these characters that have become iconic for so many of us. It's also the slow, protracted return of Agent Dale Cooper. And the question, will he return? Will we return? Will this series take us back to, you know, that Twin Peaks feeling? That, you know, that I think back in 89, 90, 91. The thing is, I didn't watch it when it first came out. I watched it probably about a year or two after only. I remember it making a big splash. I remember that it was revolutionary in terms of what TV can be, what TV can do. And people, I think people developed a kind of obsession with it. I mean, look at our blog, look at its title, look at its visual design. Some people have come away from Twin Peaks, the original, with a kind of Twin Peaks obsession.
Yep.
And I guess one question is that, does Twin Peaks The Return return us to that feeling we had back then? Does it tick the same boxes? Does it push the same buttons? So I don't know, perhaps let me ask you a question that will sound really stupid at first and possibly even when you think about it. And that's, would you say that Twin Peaks The Return is Twin Peaks as you understand it?
Yes and no. sounds like I'm chickening out here. It's 26 years, man. It would be hard and not exactly realistic to sort of replicate the feeling of the original two seasons, especially the first one. Some people have aged well. Some people have not aged well. Some people are in the third season for the last time in their lives. The feeling, no, I don't think the feeling is quite the same. And I'm not sure whether that's something we should have wished for. There are aspects that are, of course, still there. Agent Cooper, the most of the police force, Michael Horse, the secretary, Lucy, and what's her husband, Harry?
No, Andy. Andy.
Deputy Andy, of course, yeah, sorry. There are cameos by some of the original cast, if you like. I think where Twin Peaks replicates something of the old mood is probably the weirdness combined with some kind of fear of Bob or the incarnation of Bob or whatever. The weirdness, with the weirdness I mean David Lynch sort of cineastic nightmares or complete oddities, people floating in space, exuding stars, warning people with a raised finger or threatening people with outrageous violence, specters being there or not being there at the same time, haunted houses. It's sort of all there, and yet it has aged, mostly in a good way. So yes and no. I'll return to my chickening out. Did I answer your question? I have no clue. I don't even know whether your question can be answered. What's your take on your own question?
I think my answer is probably also a yes and no. I mean, I think it's twofold, but each of the two parts kind of thing kind of crystallizes or fractalizes out into many other aspects.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, there is this thing that so many of the people that are in this series, I mean, I find it amazing just how many people Lynch brought back from the original series.
Mm-hmm.
And from the movie, some people were only introduced in Fire Walk With Me. And, of course, these people are 26 years older. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've seen many things on TV or in the movies where age is visualized this effectively in very simple ways. I mean, of course, you bring back the same people 26 years later and they're older. But I think because it feels like half the cast is basically people that we knew, some of them as teenagers, some of them as young people, people in their 30s, 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them we knew as people who were already kind of getting old back then.
Yeah.
And now we see these people more than a generation later. And I think I've never seen anything that kind of also brought back home to me that I'm 26 years older. And this sounds totally trite, but I think as a memento mori, it's a fascinating series because you don't very often get that. I mean, either people have a career for a relatively short time and then they vanish,
mm-hmm.
or they have more or less a steady career. And of course, they gradually get older. You get gradually older and you don't even notice it much. But most of these people we haven't seen for 26 years.
Mm-hmm.
We might have seen them at pictures from, you know, Twin Peaks reunions or, you know, the kind of conventions that they do for fans. But most of these people, we've seen them around 1990. And this is like a school reunion that only happens 25 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And in the faces of the others and in their wrinkles and in the age that you see in their eyes, you see your own age. And I think that is something that I find quite admirable. I think it's also, you know, it's probably one of the big themes of the series. It doesn't go for nostalgia. It doesn't, as you say, you know, it doesn't give us that Twin Peaks feeling in a kind of happy, simple, commodified way.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't give us the catchphrases. It doesn't give us all the stuff that is, in a way, facile fandom, you know, the kind of thumbs up, damn fine cup of coffee. I mean, nothing bad wrong with a damn fine cup of coffee, but it doesn't turn Twin Peaks into a meme. It does something much more complex with it. And it basically, I think it gives a middle finger to nostalgia and it gives a middle finger to our wanting nostalgia. So in that respect, it doesn't give us that Twin Peaks feeling because it no longer means the same thing that it meant 26 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What it instead gives us, I think, is it's almost a meditation on getting older and how time basically only goes in one direction and you cannot turn back the clock. I don't think I've ever seen a series that is as focused on death coming. I mean, I would say every second episode, roughly, or every third episode ends with a in memory or in loving memory of this actor and that actor. And so many of them died in between the two series. So many of them died shortly after making this series.
Mm-hmm.
It's just death is omnipresent in a very curious way in this series. And that I find totally fascinating. I think it's also something that must have been on David Lynch's mind, you know, getting in touch with the people he's worked with before. Some of these were his friends. I think, for instance, you know, Harry Dean Stanton was a friend of his.
Yeah.
And of course, he died shortly after Twin Peaks was broadcast, the third season or The Return. The Log Lady died shortly after. And you can see it in every one of her scenes.
Yeah.
She knows she is dying, the character as much as the actor. And they don't shy away from that. I think so much, you know, even though death is omnipresent in so many films and series, I think there's very few of them that grapple honestly with death as something that, you know, comes for us all.
Yeah.
And I think this does it. So that in a way is, I'm not sure whether that was the yes or the no part of the answer, but I have to say that in spite of all I've just said, in spite of saying that you can't return, even if it's called Twin Peaks The Return, there are some aspects that I missed. And more than that, perhaps, I feel that it lost elements that for me very much made Twin Peaks. And it's strange, you know, while I was watching the episodes, I greatly enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
The more I think about it, the more I have certain, not problems, but regrets. You know, I think Twin Peaks, the original series, and also Fire Walk With Me, the movie, mm-hmm. were very much about domestic horrors. I mean, that's very much what Twin Peaks did, especially early in his career.
Yeah.
If you look at Eraserhead, which is very much about the horrors of becoming a father and not being prepared for it, I think. If you look at Blue Velvet, which is totally about the dark underbelly of suburban utopia. And Twin Peaks also has that, where basically if once you not ignore, but perhaps, you know, sublimate or interpret perhaps the surreal elements that David Lynch has that he loves, Twin Peaks was about domestic abuse. It was about sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. It was about the people that you should trust most, the people that you should, that should look out for you, being basically your own personal horror show.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that isn't really there or isn't there much in Twin Peaks The Return. You know, I think in a way, Laura Palmer, even though she's dead from the very beginning of the original series, she's the red thread that goes through the original series. Laura Palmer and what happened to her. And yes, you can say some kind of weird demon called Bob possessed her father mm-hmm. and abused her. But you can also say Laura Palmer was sexually abused and driven to some form of suicide, almost suicide by Bob, so to speak, by her father. And even though Twin Peaks The Return, I mean, the intro, it starts with a half-translucent image of Laura Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
She is very much absent from most of the series. And it's, I'm sure it's a conscious choice on Lynch's part, but it also means that that whole theme of abuse, of how basically the horrors may be waiting for you at home, I don't think that's there anymore. Or it's, if it's there, then it's there in a very, very different form. I don't know. What do you think?
No, seen that way, I don't think domestic abuse, terror starts at home and everything. That's not in season three anywhere, I think. I really liked season three for different reasons. There are weaknesses, but there are very, very strong scenes. But on the whole, season three is a kind of endurance test. During the second or third episode, you sort of realize there are scenes that are closed in on themselves. They're not likely to go anywhere. They're sort of self-contained small episodes, and they're just there to illustrate some aspect of the whole story. I think when I realized this was when Michael Cera was delivering his Marlon Brando impersonation on that bike. Which movie is that? Is that the Wild One with Marlon Brando that he tries to replicate in that scene?
I think so, yeah.
And
exactly.
Yeah, and Michael Cera is nothing like Marlon Brando. Michael Cera is sort of some kind of, he often plays those fearful, insecure actors, and Marlon Brando is just a physical presence not to be messed with. It's a very odd choice, Michael Cera.
It is. I mean, it's actually funny, you know. I'm not sure whether I mentioned, but I recently started watching Arrested Development, which of course has mm-hmm. a very, very young and very, very insecure Michael Cera character. And yeah. In the first season, there is one episode where, you know, he's in love or in lust or both with his cousin, mm-hmm. maybe.
Yeah.
And in order to appear more manly, he basically decides to dress up all in leather mm-hmm. and talk about, you know, how he's going to get himself a hog and everything. And in a way, it's the perfect companion piece. And I think in that respect, the Michael Cera scene in Twin Peaks is mm-hmm. almost like it's David Lynch doing, you know, taking a crack at doing his own Arrested Development episode briefly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. When I watched that scene, I knew that Michael Cera would not be, we probably wouldn't see him again anywhere in season three. There are other scenes where you think, okay, Dr. Jacoby, what's with those golden shovels and the radio broadcast? How will that ever feature in anything else? So you... I think at the beginning, there was some kind of... there must have been a row of screenplays that had much more plot in them. And that was probably when David Lynch said, no, I'm going to do something very different. And then he quit for a time. he didn't want to do it. I think the quarrel was supposed to be over money, but David Lynch said, no, I'm not going to do it. And I think people wanted to press more of the same on him. And there was a point when he said, no, I'm going to do my own thing. Mm-hmm. And if I can't do my own thing, I'm not going to do anything at all. I think that's the reason why we see season three as sort of meandering and a lot of self-contained scenes. That's my impression, at least. And it takes a really, really adventurous filmmaker to let that kind of body swap go on for such a long time. I mean, which other audience would have been okay with a personality in a different body for episodes and episodes on end? Is there some kind of precedent in TV movie history? I'm not sure. There are a lot of body swap comedies, of course. Most of them not very successful. But David Lynch, he sort of pulls it off that Dale Cooper is not in possession of his proper body for most of season three. It could have gone wrong so easily. It could have been boring and pretentious. It's still very, it demands a lot of patience from its audience, but I think there's, in every episode, they manage to keep it interesting, not least because Kyle MacLachlan is a fantastic actor, and he plays that body swap stuff perfectly, I think.
I think it's, in a way, it's like one of those jokes that are almost an anti-joke. You know, you make a joke and people laugh. You make the same joke again and people laugh a bit more. You make it the third time and they laugh less because it's getting boring.
Yeah, yeah.
And Lynch makes that same joke again and again and again.
Yes.
Till it starts infuriating you. And then he makes it again and again and again. And at some point you start laughing again. And at some point it starts becoming poignant. Yeah. And then it becomes annoying again. And then you want to throw things at the TV. And it is an endurance test. And I think it's one that pays off in most ways. It's also one that has a point. I think it's, again, this, we want Agent Cooper to return because he's so iconic. Basically, I've said that Twin Peaks had Laura Palmer running through it like a red thread. But of course, the voice of Twin Peaks, the series, the kind of personality, the image of Twin Peaks that we have is Dale Cooper, the kind of too good to be true Boy Scoutish FBI agent who's, you know, we want all FBI agents to be Dale Cooper. And Lynch briefly gives him to us at the beginning, and then he withholds him from us for at least 13, 14 episodes.
Yeah.
And there's a willfulness that there's, I mean, part of it, I think, is David Lynch being very impish and almost a bit sadistically impish, you know?
Yeah.
He says, you want Dale Cooper? Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to give you Dale Cooper, but not the way that you know him, not the way you remember him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that when the real Dale Cooper, so to speak, finally returns in, what is it, 2 episodes before the ending?
I think so, yeah.
And, you know, he's got that line which should be cheesy as hell, and it still made me cheer. You know, the I am the FBI. It's the kind of thing that exactly this kind of, you print that on a mug, on a t-shirt, because it's a meme. It's facile, it's simplistic, but where it comes after 14 episodes of withholding Dale Cooper, it's perfect.
Yeah.
And we sit there and we think he's back. You know, we cheer. We cheer like in an Avengers movie when all the Avengers turn, kind of line up in a semicircle, and now we know they're going to kick ass. And we think, yeah, Dale Cooper is going to kick ass.
Mm-hmm.
And then it all goes horribly, horribly wrong.
Yeah,
there is a sadistic element to what David Lynch does in this. And I think we're all a bit masochistic in enjoying it as much as we did. And I also enjoyed it. I think I've rarely seen anything like this. And I'm really glad I did. It's also, it didn't necessarily bring back that Twin Peaks feeling, but it brought back that David Lynch feeling. I remember when I started watching his films, I was probably a teenager, late teen, and I loved how his own brand of nightmare, you know, it seems to be totally surreal, but at the same time, there's a kind of emotional dream logic to it.
Yeah.
That really gets into not so much your brain, but beyond your brain, into your subconscious. And I think he definitely does have that again with The Return.
Yeah.
It comes at a price, though. I think it comes at the price of exactly that nostalgia that we want, and I'm fine with that. Nostalgia, I think, quickly turns cheap and also kind of insidious. It comes at the price of the domestic, which I do miss. You know, I think Twin Peaks, the original, was this weird kind of nightmarish, surreal soap opera, and there's little of that soap opera left. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Lynch felt he did all the commenting on that he could back in the late 80s, early 90s. What we get instead is fascinating. It's unique. It's also very piecemeal. And I think another thing that I actually do miss compared to the best of the original series is the return rarely feels focused, perhaps. Mm, you know, because of that piecemeal thing. It does feel a bit like Lynch and Frost did Freefall associations at times.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that's fascinating. It's surprising. You never know what the next scene is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have to say that there's few episodes, a few scenes that I enjoyed as much as, for instance, the episode that we talked about earlier on this podcast, mm-hmm. the one where Maddie Ferguson gets killed mm-hmm. by Bob
yeah.
Or by Leland. And there was also very little that had the intensity of the final episode of the original Twin Peaks. The episode that I think is closest to all of that, to having that kind of coherent intensity, is probably episode 8. And episode 8, I'm sorry, but I don't think it can be described as anything other than a complete and utter mindfuck in the best possible way.
Yes. I completely agree, man. Yeah.
And it's also, I think it's the episode that I will remember most strongly from all of it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, how can you not? It's such an utter, you can't compare it to anything. You can't even properly describe what it is and what it's about. It abuses weirdness to the point of something new. I don't know. I have an inkling that when David Lynch watched the dailies for that episode, he probably thought, well, I've done it. You know, I've outlinched even myself now. It's some kind of nightmarish nuclear Armageddon rebirth. I already said nightmare. Shall I say it four times more? It's you can't describe it. You have to see it. It's sort of, it's magnificent, but it's also completely wacko. It's the one episode where the Nine Inch Nails song is the sanest thing in the whole episode. I'm not surprised that the producers were quarreling with Lynch. I mean, if Lynch laid those story ideas before them, they probably said, well, it's not even a proper story. And they were right. I mean, I would have understood their fear. How many episodes? 18 episodes of weirdness, in a way. There is some kind of plot. There are cameos from the old gang. I mean, Gary Hershberger is there for about 5 minutes, and James Hurley is there for a few minutes. Majkin Amick is also there. Sherilyn Fenn has some kind of weird quarrel on the dance floor. Hell, I mean, who else would have done it like that? It's only Lynch. The thing is, look at all the other revivals. There are catastrophic revivals, like Friends. There are very weak revivals, like Gilmore Girls. Boy, am I glad that season 3 is weird like that. It brings you new territory with partly old ingredients. Yeah, some ingredients mm-hmm. are missing. But the thing is, there are a few aspects I miss about myself when I was 26 year old mm-hmm. younger. I don't want to go back, don't get me wrong, but I there are some aspects of myself that I miss that I would gladly have right now that my 46 old self misses. So I think you can be nostalgic about that, but then you have to go on with what you have. And that's sort of what Lynch did. And he damn well did what he wanted to do with the material.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said, I think that probably the major theme of the series is you cannot turn back the clock as much as you want. You can't go back. You can go and only go forward, and possibly in going forward, you're going to recapture something, but at a price, at a risk.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, I think there is one story strand, if you can call it that, because I think all in all, it's also not more than 5 to 10 minutes, that feels like old school Twin Peaks, but that at the same time very much has this theme of aging in there, and of you're only going to get old and you're not going to go back to where you started, at least not by going backwards. Mm. And that's, this is where you can bring out your favorite Norma Jennings t-shirt. You've got the story between Big Ed Hurley and Norma Jennings, who in the original series, they were already, I don't know, in their 40s probably, possibly late 40s. I
think so.
They were already not the youngest. And basically the two of them, they should have been the golden couple. Their story goes back to high school when they were a couple, but then things went bad and horribly wrong in surreal nightmare soap opera ways. Mm-hmm. And Nadine Hurley, one of the weirdest characters of the original Twin Peaks, comes in, the one-eyed woman. Mm-hmm. And in a way that I think is both ironic, I mean, he has fun with it, Lynch does, but also genuinely sweet. He brings those two lovers who couldn't be together for 26 years. He brings them together with a cheesy song, and he knows it's cheesy, and he has a laugh with it, and he still means it. So these are the only two characters that, in a way, they feel like they're out of the original series, even in their older version. Mm-hmm. And it feels like for 5 minutes, Lynch says, I'm going to give you what you want. And you're going to regret it. And I wouldn't want an entire series like that. I wouldn't want an entire series made up of looking back and being nostalgic and saying, remember when. Mm-hmm. I think I largely agree with Tony Soprano on remember when being the lowest form of communication. But I'm still glad that scene is there. It feels like, even though Lynch kind of gives a middle finger to this idea of nostalgia, he says that sometimes it can work out. Mm-hmm. And it's nice that it works out for two people who are old, you know, they don't have that many more years. You know, if we had another Twin Peaks revival in another 25 or 26 years, we'd probably have two episodes in loving memory of Norma Jennings and Big Ed Hurley.
Oh man, that hurts. Yeah.
But we'll know that the two of them made it work out. Lynch made it work out for them. So it's like he had a moment of sweetness in him, and Lynch isn't often sweet, and that's okay. We don't go to Lynch for him to be sweet. But it makes it all the more precious when he has his moments of sweetness.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And then we go back to, you know, kind of superpowered Englishman with green gardening gloves punching the evil out of a, I don't know, evil coop.
Yeah.
And nuclear bomb explosions and galactic vomit and, It's funny, I think, in a way, even though Lynch doesn't really go back to the original Twin Peaks, he doesn't do nostalgia there, but I think there were quite a few scenes where I felt he's actually referring to his earlier films, not his TV series, but his films. Yeah. There were scenes every now and then where I thought, this scene could have been out of Lost Highway, this scene could have been out of Blue Velvet, this scene could have been out of Mulholland Drive. And it's weird, there's even a couple of scenes that feel like they could have been out of someone else's movies. I mean, there's two characters, two killers that feel like they're out of a Quentin Tarantino movie.
Is that Jeremy Davis and someone else?
No, it's Jennifer Jason Leigh and Tim Roth. Let's face it, they are out of a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, they are. Exactly, yeah. No, I think it... I have a lot of admiration for season 3. It doesn't cater to anyone. I think David Lynch also took the risk of not gaining any new wider audience for Twin Peaks. I mean, if you catch season 3 on the net or on TV, or whether you see it at a friend's house, if you are 20, 25 now, there is only a minority that thinks, oh, this is pretty good. You know, I have to go back to the original series, because there are too many differences between the first two seasons and season 3 in order to to get the David Lynch bug through season three. When you go back to season one after having seen season three, there is sort of, you sort of sober up because you realize, oh, he can do plot development if he wants to. But I think there's only a small group of new fans that he might have gained with season three. But if you liked season three, then you're probably in for all the other David Lynch stuff as well. I mean, there must be people who discover David Lynch through Twin Peaks: The Return and then go back to the other seasons and to his other movies.
Mm-hmm.
But,
absolutely.
But it's not the easiest. It's not an easy gateway drug because he makes it especially hard to watch that as a series.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I mean, he doesn't make any concessions. He doesn't make it easy for you. It's, if Twin Peaks, the original series, was kind of David Lynch for beginners, this is, you know, David Lynch for I don't even know what this is.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, even though there's some things that frustrate me about the series, some things that I miss in there that I thought he could have done without falling into the trap of cheap nostalgia, I would definitely say that I'm, you know, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot. I am glad I saw possibly the most unique thing on TV. I mean, it makes series like Hannibal, which is already pretty Lynchian in some ways, it makes Hannibal look like Friends, basically.
Wow, what a comparison.
I'll be there exactly. For you.
Exactly. And each episode he ends with them eating one of the friends. I don't want to eat David Schwimmer. He's stringy.
So it's a 6-episode series.
Exactly. Oh. It's, you know, I think that's what they should do. Limited series and then it's over. Talking of which, I think the moment that they showed the last episode, there were these articles saying, is there going to be a season 4? Is there going to be the return of the return?
Yeah.
Will Lynch make more Twin Peaks? And some people saying, of course he will. Some people saying, of course he won't. Mm-hmm. Some people saying, who's going to give him the money to do that? Do you think there will be more Twin Peaks? And do you want there to be more Twin Peaks?
I want there to be more Twin Peaks. But I want it to be there the David Lynch way and not any producer's idea of sort of wrapping up the series. I mean, David Lynch will probably say no to any kind of end or coda or explanation or whatever, and I'm glad. The people that demand more Twin Peaks, I really, really hope they don't ask for any kind of what does it all mean, because that's probably what the producers have in mind when they agree to more Twin Peaks. I mean, if there will be more Twin Peaks, nothing will be explained. There will be more of David Lynch weird greatness or great weirdness or whatever you want to label it. Don't expect to any kind of sane, clear, coherent storytelling. It won't happen.
Mm-hmm.
I already think that the last two episodes or the last double episode of season three, that is very much, it's very atmospheric, but it's basically plot driven. It's much more plot driven than any of the other episodes. I think that's already a compromise. David Lynch wanting to sort of signal, okay, Dale Cooper's back. He goes to a certain place. He sees a certain lady. You know, we're back in comparably sane territory and there's some kind of plot development and things like that. That's David Lynch's way of saying, okay, we're approaching the end. But I think it's a compromise. David Lynch said, okay, plot driven. We can't end just for the sake of ending. We need some kind of at least minute wrapping up. But he can always prolong that. He can always go back to that and tell us more. But it's his choice. I mean, he can do 3 episodes more. He can do 30 episodes more. As long as he has the intention or the ideas or the stamina to sort of perpetuate that. And I'm probably going to be there. I'm probably going to watch it. But I really don't want to see anything, any kind of proper closure.
Exactly. I mean, I see where you're coming from, but I don't quite agree with you on him compromising in those last two episodes. I agree that they're more plot-driven, but I think it's also Lynch doing a bait and switch. And I think it's actually the last 5 minutes of The Return, I think in some ways are very much like the last 5 minutes of the original series. It's David Lynch dangles the possibility of Dale Cooper triumphing in front of us. You know, he's back, the guy that we want, the guy who solves all the problems, the guy who knows, you know, not only how to save the girl, save the world, but also where to get a damn good cup of coffee. And he fails. We don't quite understand how or why or what it means, but he fails. It's Norma Jennings and Big Ed Hurley, they get a happy end. But Dale Cooper, no. What we're going to get is the hope of triumph smashed. And I think the original Twin Peaks did that. I think the Return did that. And I don't think, if even if Lynch did another 10 series, which he's not going to do, I think he would always end on that. I don't think that David Lynch thinks that the Dale Coopers of this world triumph. And if they triumph, they only triumph because they turn into something entirely different than what they are. And then you have to ask, is it a triumph? So our hopes of returning to what once was can only get dashed. And I think that's what Lynch will do. If he continues doing it, he will continue dashing our hopes in fun and fascinating ways.
And we'll cheer and clap and, you know, throw around popcorn and things.
And do podcasts, exactly.
Well, I can see, I never had the feeling that I was being, I don't know, that Lynch was specifically being sadistic for the sake of being sadistic. But I partly agree with what you say about Lynch being sadistic with towards it, his audience. But he's probably the only filmmaker I can accept that kind of sadism from. All the others, I would go, ah, no, come on.
In the end, only David Lynch can give us that David Lynch feeling. There's such a thing as Lynchian, but it never feels like the real thing, like the original.
Yeah. I mean, I said more than once on that podcast here that I am a sucker for atmosphere. If everything else fails, if the plot fails, if the acting fails, if the casting is a joke, go for the atmosphere. If there is anything there, let the atmosphere wash over you and see what you get out of the movie. At least you get that. With Lynch, you can sort of be sure that there will he will atmosphere the hell out of you. I mean, there's that scene with the, there's the abandoned gas station where all those spectral hobos go in and out, and I could watch that for half an hour, not a problem. I mean, it's very much like that Parisian ad he did in the 90s. You remember that one? The whole backwards thing, also featuring, I think, a gas station. I can watch that for the atmosphere. It's enough for me, you know? Nobody has to wail a song. No one has to die a horrible death. It's just hobos being there and not being there at the same time, haunting that abandoned gas station. Wow. It's...
And if I'm ever going to have another band that I play in, it's going to be called David Lynch and the Spectral Hobos.
So he does and does not have a backup band.
Exactly.
It's like the Schrödingers, you know, it's like the Kelly family. No, I didn't mind that season 3 was so disjointed. If I gave that impression, nah. At the time you're watching it, you think, yeah, but what's it gonna lead to? Maybe that's because we're trained to sort of watch for the plot, you know, where we sometimes we cling to logic because that's what makes us safe and everything. But sometimes you have to let go, and David Lynch is very determined of the audience letting go, and then he presents us with a nightmare when we are most vulnerable in a way. Or is that cheesy? I have no idea. That's what it feels like to watch a David Lynch movie. He gets you, to open up, and then he puts the knife in.
Oh. That's probably a good moment at which to have a disappointing, frightening, and confusing ending. So people can wonder, will there be a next one?
Next podcast?
Yeah.
Well, do you want to crush anyone's hopes? I don't want to.
Yeah. I'm not quite sure which answer would be the crushing the hopes bit, but...
Well, rumor has it we have some pretty faithful listeners. I just scared myself witless.
So, to those three or four people out there, thank you very much for listening.
Thanks a lot. The dozen is full. Meet you again in a month's time. Take care and see good stuff. Goodbye.
Absolutely. Goodbye.
When the twilight is gone, and no songbirds are singing, when the twilight is gone, you come into my heart, and here in my heart you will stay. While I pray, my prayer is to linger with you at the end of the day in a dream. That's...